But for the government and for government-funded scientists and especially educators and academics, you're funded by the government, but when your government wants to suppress what you want to say, do you have a duty to speak out about that? Hello and welcome to Further Research Needed, the only charity dedicated to the eventual reintroduction of scientists into the wild. My name is Christopher Wood, and I'm joined by my co-hosts,
Jan-Philipp Reising.
I'm Hannes Feurer.
And today I wanted to ask the question, are scientists being censored? And are there any circumstances where this would be justified? This topic comes from a couple of discussions that Hannes and I have been having about some friends and colleagues that we've talked to, where there's been some examples of them being, as scientists, being censored, whether what they can post online or what they are prepared to say publicly about what they're doing. And personally, I've never experienced censorship myself, but I was shocked to think that this could happen. So the example I have is from a friend, let's call him Bob, and he works for a company, and we were talking about some really interesting stuff about what they're doing currently. And I asked if they wanted to appear on the show and talk about that. And they said that they couldn't. They were actually legally obliged to not, they couldn't post anything about what the work that they do, either online or on in print media and all the sort of old school media. And this, yeah, just got me thinking about what, I don't think anyone should be censored, and especially for scientists. But I think the topic is, it's more nuanced than that. So I suppose the first question for this is, have either of you experienced censorship, or do you know of people who've experienced censorship?
So before I start, I want to open the beer, which I've been eyeballing for a while now.
Same.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Oh, shit. This went over the mic.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Prost.
Yes, I did experience pretty much the exact same thing as you. Slightly different, though. The person I was speaking to is a professor. Let's call her Alice. And Alice is an NIH employee. So she's a government employee in the United States. And I'm not sure if they actually have a clause that they cannot talk in public. Well, obviously they don't, because scientists, especially government employees, are public speakers. But in this particular case, the topic was somewhat critical about science. And I only reached out to this person because I heard them speak in a different environment and I heard them speak somewhat critically about something going on in science right now. So I asked them, would you want to elaborate on the podcast? And they said, oh, I should have not said that. I actually cannot at least not criticize US state policy publicly. And this was somewhat shocking that, well, in a way, I guess we can discuss about if that's shocking or not, or if that should be this way or not. But in the end, I would say it was nothing major that I want to talk about with Alice. Nothing too critical, especially not of US policy. It was a completely different topic. But still, they wouldn't want to appear on the podcast because apparently scientists from the NIH have been making very bad experiences in the last years. Apparently, this was especially bad under the Bush administration for climate scientists who wanted to speak up and who had their work reviewed by NASA before. Sorry, in this case, it was a NASA employee, not an NIH employee. The specific case who I read about. And NASA administration was reviewing the material they wanted to put out into the public space. And I think we have to distinguish between industry and academia in this case, because Bob is in a large corporation, a private corporation, while Alice is an employee from the state. So that's very different.
Yeah, definitely. I think because I kind of want to get into whether scientists should, like, if it's morally right, if scientists should be able to speak out. And I think there is a distinction between the two examples there.
Yeah.
Potentially.
So I've been thinking about this, and I personally have never experienced any kind of censorship And also, I've been trying to think if I know anybody who has experienced this, and I couldn't think of it, so I guess I've been lucky. But now that we're talking about it, I'm kind of wondering if there were certain opportunities that I didn't get because I just speak my mind and do not have kind of the policy angle or the reputation of the university in mind. So yeah, I mean, I have no personal experience, but I'm also not very sensitive to it.
Right. I think we have to distinguish between three cases: the academic researcher, the government researcher, and the industry researcher. And the two extremes are, of course, the academic and the industry, because academic researchers have basically no restriction on free speech, right? We have a lot of cases of professors who have very controversial opinions, which they voice in the public space, and the university does not censor them. But often, at least, they say they cannot teach these things in their lectures, but that's a different matter again.
So I'd like to come back to that, because I think that's changing. That
right.
It's the sort of the myth of academia is, or that idea of academia is now changing.
Yeah, that's definitely worth discussing if that is changing. And then at the very other end, we have industry, where a company, of course, has to protect their intellectual property, especially in research and development. Of course, that's why they cannot allow their R&D personnel to talk about what they work on, obviously. But then there's this in between, the case of Bob, who does not do research and development. And still, Bob cannot talk even about things completely unrelated to that. Let's say an education YouTube channel would still be forbidden.
I think, that's where and I'm not sure that the company's aim is to suppress Bob's ability to teach children on YouTube. It's just that it's easier to write a rule that is all-encompassing and blanket than to make a nuanced rule that says you can, but you can't do something that brings the company into disrepute, because how do you define that? Like,
right.
Where you get into all sorts of legal wrangling at that point where you have some rule like that.
But do you think that's easier? Or let's put it this way. Can a person actually be fired based on a law like this? Because in the end, the company would infringe on the freedom of speech, and any contract that would infringe our basic rights is not valid, right?
So I'm intrigued, because the concept of freedom of speech isn't, I suppose, a freedom of consequence of speech. It's only that you can say the thing you're saying. So if you say something,
of course,
and a company fires you, that's okay, because you can keep saying, even after you've been fired, you can keep saying the thing you've just said. You're not stopped from that.
No, that's not what freedom of speech is, right? It is exactly that you can say everything, not everything, but most things, and do not have to expect consequences from that. Very different than in a totalitarian regime where you get consequences for things you say, like criticizing the government as a journalist.
You get consequences from the government, but you don't get consequences from other people, or like from a private company. The private company can go off and do whatever it wants to do.
But I don't think this is like very
absolutely not, right?
I think that's not very... I think there might also be a change in society as well, but if you think about stuff like you're a baker and you're refusing to bake like a wedding cake for a gay couple, like that's kind of rolled into this whole freedom of speech argument, and you have the exact kind of thing happening, right? You have like a private person having a statement or a certain lifestyle, and then a company trying to deny their service. And I think that should not be allowed, but it also cuts both ways, right? So if someone says like very right wing, maybe even pro-Nazi things, and the company fires their employee for that, I'm kind of like on board with that. And I think that's a good thing, right? But it's really hard to find the balance there, like what is okay and what is not okay. So it's not as cut and dry that you can say, oh, freedom of speech is like everything is allowed, or it's not. I think it's like more nuanced.
The example you brought about, what do you call that? Yeah, voicing Nazi ideology, especially in Germany, is not covered by freedom of speech. Denying the Holocaust is I'm not sure to which degree illegal in Germany, but you can definitely get fined for that and get legal there are legal consequences to it. I think we're drifting off a bit off topic a bit here, but in the end, speaking about something that does not conflict directly with the company's interest and suppressing speech about something that does not directly conflict with the company's interest would definitely be covered by freedom of speech, right? And I don't know how the company can restrict that. I don't see it. But also, I'm not a legal expert. None of us is, unfortunately. But I would like to hear the opinion of someone who actually knows what this is about, and this, if such a clause is legal, and if you could get fired based on that.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, even if we don't think about like the freedom of speech aspects of it, I think it's wrong for a company to kind of have this broad power over what you're allowed to say or not, right? Like, mm-hmm. just intuitively, I think it's okay for a company to protect their IP, but kind of reining you in all these other dimensions is, yeah, they shouldn't have that power. And even if it's legally okay, if it's in your contract and you sign it, that it's legally binding, I think, like, just from a moral standpoint, that's not okay.
This, I think this is a broader question, because there's a lot of examples of people who are do something abhorrent on social media outside of the company, whatever it is, in a park or whatever, and then they get called out on social media and the company then eventually fires them as a reputational risk kind of thing. And this is a broader question for society, but I think more specifically here, is there a duty of truth for scientists when it comes to the work they do and the things that they want to? There's not only a duty of truth, but also a duty of education. So educating the public, and is that a higher ideal than the restrictive rules that you may be placed on either in a company or by the government that you work for?
I think that might be true for academia, but I can see how that would be lifted in if you're working in the industry, right? Because you're being paid to do your research, but you're not necessarily being paid as a researcher, if you understand like what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, not as a public scientist. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but you're not being being funded by tax money or that kind of stuff. So you're working for the company to solve a problem. So you're more an engineer, if you want to use that term, than a scientist, so to speak. Although that distinction is also problematic. But if you are being paid by tax money, I think you definitely have an obligation towards the public sphere.
So I think this is where it gets really interesting, because I think the company thing, it's more of a by rote legal matter, because you can understand why a company would want to suppress and like maintain its reputation no matter what. But for the government and for government funded scientists and especially educators and academics, you're funded by the government, but when your government wants to suppress what you want to say, do you have a duty to speak out about that? And to,
I think we have to consider something that goes in for both government and corporation, is that it is important to distinguish if a person speaks their personal opinion or if it speaks for the institution. And the government has only few specific people who speak for the government. But of course, every government scientist can speak for themselves, and it's important to make this distinction. Am I speaking as like the scientist, the person I am, or do I speak for the government? And I think that's why it's also important for the government to sometimes review statements or sometimes even, I don't want to really go as far and say censor them, but at least to some degree, have a look at this. Because it's important that not everyone who works for the government and speaks publicly will therefore represent the government, but everything the government says as its own public body has to be vetted, right? In
this kind of sparks, have you seen on a lot of people's Twitter bios, they say at the bottom of them, all opinions are my own, or whatever?
Right.
And why are people putting that there? Is that exactly this, that they're trying to say, you know, I might be the head of this journal, Nature or Science or whatever, but when I tweet here and I, you know, slag off cats, that's my own, like, the whole of the journal nature does not believe that cats are rubbish. Like, it's a really weird fact that that people feel the need to write that. But I think it might be a symptom of this.
Yeah, I think it's important if you work for a corporation or some institution that you make sure what you say you speak for yourself and not for the entire institution. That's important for you, but also for the institution, of course. So that's why I can see how a company or the government wants to make this distinction, but also the person wants to make this distinction, right? And this goes for both, I think. Could I quickly put an insert here to something that I want to say before? Philip, you said almost something along the lines, whatever I put in my contract is legally binding, but that's not true. You can put things in a contract that are illegal, but that doesn't make them legal. Like, you cannot ask for someone to give up their basic human rights, write in a contract, both sign them, and therefore the human rights are gone. That's not the case. You cannot break a law in a contract. The same way, for example, the government tells us we have a 3 months notice or the right of 3 months notice if we have to leave our apartment. And even if you put it in a contract, you have a 1 month notice, it's still 3 months. The contract doesn't break that law.
I think that depends on the country. I'm not sure that's true. Because in the UK, there's a lot of things that you sign into your contracts that then break the overall law. So the big one is the EU Working Time Directive. I as a postdoc in the UK, signed contracts that stated, I personally decide not to be part of the EU Working Time Directive.
Right. I guess the EU directive is not a law, right? The EU doesn't pass laws per se that apply to everyone, but...
But I think that was the reason why I said that. So, I mean, we can go into the weeds and try to figure out what the laws are, but I don't think that's really the interesting point, right? What is interesting is why do we think that is wrong, right? Regardless of what the rules are and if, like, a local contract breaks, like, the national law or whatsoever. Like, the question is, do we think that's right or not, regardless of what the legal situation is?
Yes to both, I think. And I would claim it infringes on freedom of speech, which is one of these very basic human rights that we all mostly agree on, everyone should have.
So this is, I think this comes nicely onto my next point in a way. So in general, I think we might be agreed that... it's a bad thing to suppress scientists or any worker, potentially because of the rights to freedom of expression, but also because it reduces free exchange of ideas between people. But are there any points where it might be justified to suppress scientists? I'm particularly thinking, maybe because of the times, but yeah, in a crisis, should you suppress scientific discussion and reduce the amount of interchange of ideas while you go through this crisis?
I mean, I think there might be some edge cases where you can debate it, but in the most cases, I don't see any reason. So, for example, if you would be in war and there would be, like, for example, the scientists involved in the Manhattan Project went out and published their results on the nuclear bomb, and then Nazi Germany would have gotten that information and could have built their own bomb. I think that would be an edge case where you could argue, well, if one of them wanted to do this, then the government would have been within their rights to suppress their disinformation. But I think even in this case, I don't think it's like super crystal clear, because one of the super fundamental ideas of science is that science is for every human and everybody should have access to it.
Right. You could argue that government science is not for everyone, but government science is mainly for the state and therefore has to be treated as the state's intellectual property. And therefore,
but that would
the state,
not be my opinion.
And therefore the state can classify certain research as confidential and can restrict scientists from publishing it. At least for a while, maybe even forever, at least that's what happened. And I think that's an important point, that in specific times, information may need to be classified.
But so it's easy to imagine. So with weapons research, you can see a very like clear reason. But then we move on to slightly more nuanced areas where, say, so the one you brought up, climate change, is a big one, where scientists were being paid by the government in the same way that the weapons scientists were being paid, yet they were suppressed when there was a clear and present danger, and that they were trying to inform the public about that. So it might go more to a moral point. It kind of goes to a whistleblower argument, in that it, you know, a lot of the contracts you sign are nullified when a whistleblower goes to the government and says this company is doing something illegal, because it's good for the public that this thing has happened. It just becomes very, very complicated when the government is the employer that you're blowing the whistle on, and yeah, then, you know, all hell breaks loose.
I think what the government wants in many cases, no, what the government wants in general is to, if they have some policy on some issue, to at least have a clear line from their scientists. Because imagine, let's maybe go back to the Bush administration, where climate change wasn't seen as much as a threat as at least we here see it in Europe today. And therefore, I guess scientists publishing on climate change in the name of the government would be seen as a conflict to national policy. And that's, of course, something they don't want, because this sparks, what do you call that, not work for unity?
Disunity.
But I don't think that's a really valid argument. If you, as a government or as a administration, don't believe in a certain bit of science, or you disagree with it, then it's absolutely unmoral to suppress any kind of other information. If you have good reason to believe that climate change is not a thing, that you should allow climate change scientists who believe in that to publish, and you would assume that if your arguments are stronger, then they're going to prevail. I don't think that's a valid argument why you would suppress in the name of unity that kind of information.
Yo, yes, I completely agree. Yo, yes, I completely agree. But still, that's the reason in the end, I guess.
But I mean, yeah. No, I agree that in reality that might be the reason, but there are also other reasons as well. Like, governments are not acting in a vacuum, right? So they have company interests and all these kinds of stuff, which I would assume were the reason why the Bush administration tried to stifle this kind of research. But I think, like, an interesting point is that in the case of Alice, it's not that the government strictly prohibits it, but it sounds to me like she's expecting there might be repercussions of some kind.
Exactly.
Or like maybe she's not going to get the grants that she would get otherwise. So I think that's even, yeah, it's even more difficult, because with the, like, if you have a contract, you can argue with the contract and go, this is immoral, this contract is not valid, whatever, you can put it on another level. But if it's just the fear of repercussions, then you can't really do anything against that, right?
Yeah, well, this is actually one of the downsides of censorship in the past, that people will be much more careful to even say things in general, may it be valid or not valid, or may it be in accordance with the government policy or not. But people, government scientists, are much less likely to say anything. And that's, I think, a real danger from all of this.
Yeah, it comes up time and again, and it ends up in politics, and it's not discussed by scientists themselves. But I know of several examples in the UK, not just climate change, but particularly drugs policy, where government scientists have recommended something happen. Usually it's legalization, and then they have been dismissed by the government, so they speak out, and they have then been destroyed in the media and attacked and all this sort of stuff. And that climate of fear that the government generates around these scientists sort of negates the point of having these independent, what the government frame as independent panels of scientists to go and do something. And again, it's coming up currently with the coronavirus outbreak, where these suggestions from these epidemiologists, if they don't agree with the politics, then the government dismiss them. And so you've kind of destroyed the point of having scientists around to so-called speak the truth to power.
Right.
But then the question is, especially if scientists disagree. So if you have two sets of scientists on a government panel, who one is going for one thing and one is going for the other, and they both start publicly discussing the nuances of scientific debate about this issue, and in the media, let's say, is that helpful for society to have the debate pushed out there and then for people to lose trust in the outcome? The whatever's then decided upon, they will then not, people will be aware of the counter argument and maybe not abide by the rule that's now put in place because of it.
So you mean because there is no unity, people will be less likely to actually trust the scientists and the outcomes of it because it didn't seem like a nice round story?
I think trust the government, but yeah, also trust the science behind the government's decision, definitely, yeah.
But I think what we see is like almost the opposite. I feel like especially in like general media, you have that if you have a panel, you always have to have both sides. That's like an unwritten rule of journalism. And I think it's in some cases absolutely detrimental. If 99.9% of scientists agree that climate change is happening, and you have to find the one crackpot who says, no, it's not happening, it's not man-made, whatever, then you basically give equal value to both these opinions, which is not a very good reflection of reality. So that would be a detrimental case where you just for the sake of having two opinions kind of miss the point. But in other cases, I think it's not detrimental per se to just have disagreement on scientific facts if that is actually where the science is at.
So you would want to ask the media or journalists to make that call, how united the scientific community is on the field, or at least to what degree there is disagreement, and then try to cover that accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, it
sounds hard, like a hell of a task.
Yeah, sure. But on the other hand, that's what journalists do all the time, right? Mm. They look at the facts and they try to give a representative reflection of what's going on, right? So it's not like this is what they're doing anyways.
So to get back to Chris's original question, if we should have this debate in public, most of me wants to say, yes, absolutely. Science has to be transparent and has to happen in the public space, both in order for people to trust science, but also to understand the scientific process and to understand where these results and these positions come from based on the data. On the other hand, and this is kind of on the fence about this because of what I'm going to say next. On the other hand, this having this live debate, but also generating data live and seeing the data like it is happening right now with the corona crisis, allows people to pick scientific data which supports their position, which they have already for whatever reason, and use it as an argument for their case, even though there is still no scientific consensus on it. And I think this has been done even by governments in the current crisis. Good data was so sparse, and the results that came out over the last half a year, it's now end of May, the results that came out over the last half a year on the entire planet was kind of conflicting on many issues. So governments had to kind of pick and choose what they deemed the best data, I guess. And seemed a bit, not super scientific at least.
I mean, I completely agree. I think we're implying that the scientists having under discussion are completely rational actors within this system, but they personally have political views and are going on Twitter to espouse their crazy, like I follow quite a lot of chemists, and the amount of stuff they're talking about pandemics and epidemiology is, you know, it's just as flawed as anything else. But
even though they don't really have any expertise, or at least not more expertise on the subject than an electrical engineer.
No, exactly. And you can't deny that the epidemiologists who are consulted will not have their own political views. And so when it comes to decisions made, they will apply that as well. So seeing them debate that and seeing where potentially their flawed arguments lie could be very important for the public. Again, the issue is that we then assume that the public is entirely rational and capable of following the nuanced argument and identifying bias in the argument. And it's very difficult. Like, no one can, I suppose, is you don't know what people are up to, and the arguments behind them. But it's probably better that it's in the open, even if maybe that so that the in 10 years, 20 years time, historians can pore through the debates to see how people were reacting to these sorts of things.
Right.
So there's also another risk. If you would only have one opinion, especially with stuff that's like super fast moving, like a pandemic, then you run the risk of society basically losing faith in science, right? If you would have come out like within the first month and would have said, whatever, I don't want to give a specific example, but something that was thought to be true at the time and turned out to be not the case, then you're losing trust in science. So the next time they're going to come out and say, oh, but this is now we really know, then even I would go, yeah, well, are you really sure? Because last time you said you were sure and you were not. So what's going on?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I've had a lot of discussions exactly about this. And if I can give a specific example in your stead, it would be the death rate of the coronavirus, which was initially reported. I think the first reports were around 3%, and then it dropped to 1, then dropped below 1, and then we talked about the incidence fatality, because apparently we missed so many cases, which was then around somewhere between 0.2. And that's a gigantic margin, right? And as Philip said, of course, who do you trust then?
But I think it was like in the discussion we had, it was like open that this is kind of a moving target. I didn't feel like someone was coming out and saying this is the absolute number and there was no other opinion.
Exactly, exactly. But this is still, I think this kind of disappears in such an article, especially because the news agencies, of course, want the core and the headline, right? And they say, well, scientists say death rate is at 3%. And then you read through and say, well, the data isn't very good. There are only very low sample number. What do you call it? Low sample size. And the data isn't very reliable. But I think you still go with this 3%. That's something that you always said. If you keep repeating something over and over, you start believing it, even if it might not be true.
Exactly. But here, so the effect here was more like you hear one news outlet saying, oh, it's maybe 2.2%, another outlet saying, oh, it's maybe 0.5%. Then you hear, oh, in Germany, it's 0.4, whatever. You are hearing different messages from different outlets and over time changing, which reflected the situation, I think. I mean, I don't know. I don't have the data, but that was my impression, versus basically the media picking up on one detail and just running with it while, like, whatever, chocolate cures cancer, media running with it, like it's everywhere. And then the scientist comes out, say, oh, I actually have like made a mistake in my calculations. That's not true. And then you never hear about that. So it was not that kind of case.
Yeah, I mean, it's been nice to see potentially whistleblowers coming out from scientists. Like, there's always been another report come out saying, I don't think this is right. I don't think this R number is correct. And then, you know, and it's because it's in the public interest, whatever that means, it has been taken up by the media and presented again. And so it's been a good example of this working. But in general, for more obscure things, let's say, and particularly things that the public aren't happy with, let's say like not using your car and this sort of thing, that there is still suppression of the debate or suppression of the scientists, suppression of the other side of the argument, depending on where that's going. So I suppose the question is, are scientists special in there that they have more access to free speech than the rest of the population? Or is it just in general that free speech is a good thing? Or should scientists potentially have less free speech when it comes to questions of the public good and where a decision needs to be made?
So I feel like for me, the discussion showed me clearly that I think it's quite alarming that we have the feeling that there's more censoring going on than maybe before. It might either be that, like, during our education, we were just not as aware. But if that's really a trend, I think that would be very alarming. And I would like to, if we have to err on one side, then rather on the side that we have too much free speech or too little censoring than the other way around. But I mean, we also mentioned some edge cases where it might be necessary. So, but yeah, I think it's a worrisome thing.
I am completely with Philip on this one. Of course, free speech applies to scientists as much as to any other person. But I think as a scientist, you almost have the duty to make your science transparent and speak up. And there is the downsides that we have been mentioning, like the government not presenting itself as a unity with one idea, or the public cherry-picking data based on science that is not yet conclusive. But these are issues that can be tackled in a different way, for example, through better science communication, both on the government side as on the media side. And it would be detrimental to censor science because of these issues, but we have to tackle them in another way.
I agree. I think what I hadn't thought about before we started talking was that the greatest strength of science is the fact that there is a plurality of ideas, and that eventually maybe one of those ideas becomes the most most likely answer to the question, which is nice. And to suppress that reduces it, it makes the public more suspicious of science over time. And so people should see that process happening.
You're right. Unfortunately, this process is painfully slow, especially in a crisis when we need good data to base policies on. And I guess it's just too slow for, I mean, it's too slow for all of us, be honest. We would all have liked better data early on, then we could have made better decisions, but that's all it is.
Yeah, I think, as always, further research is needed.
Thank you all for listening. If you have any comments, questions, or feedback, please get in touch on Twitter at FRN-podcast or email under contact@frn-podcast.com. In 2 weeks, we return for another round of The Guessing Game. If you want to support the show, consider becoming a Patreon. We have exciting rewards waiting for you. Music credits go to Jay Patterson. Thank you again for listening, and please consider subscribing. See you in 2 weeks.